Welcome to this episode of the First Moves podcast. This week, we're talking to Thomas Ubelacker, a student here at Maastricht University who has three different organizations around AI. The first being Digicust, a company helping automate custom declaration processes. Then there's Textures, helping other organizations implement AI. And finally, AIM, basically using large language models to solve the big issues that we're facing here in Europe. If you want to hear about how AI is changing and will change the world from somebody who's actually working in the field themselves and growing companies working with AI, then make sure you listen to this episode. It's extremely interesting. There's loads of insights, and we really enjoyed the conversation. We hope you enjoy the episode. Thomas, welcome. Could you please introduce yourself and what kind of work you do?
Pleasure. I'm by heart a software engineer. I've started engineering when I was like 13 years old, and small projects led to bigger projects. With 16, I started my first startup company, which 2 years later failed. But it was a great learning experience. So what I'm doing right now is, like, since 5 years, I have a company in customs clearance automation, B2B. Started like with like three co-founders. Now we're like around 35 people. In the company, and everything built around artificial intelligence. Like, we tried to solve a very difficult problem, which became easier over time as also large language models, etc., emerged. And so it's like one of my foundations of what I'm doing for work. Another one is Textures, which is like an AI consultancy that we founded like a year ago, where we hopped on the opportunities that came with emergence of large language models, of like AI models that understand text, that can reason on text, that can simulate like the thinking processes of human beings, and also like since recently multimodality with video processing, audio processing, etc. So that opens a lot of opportunities for automation that previously were just not accessible. And we try to bring that into companies, teach companies, organizations on how to make use of them, how to exploit them. That's very much of what I'm doing for work.
Very cool. I just want to zoom in on when you were 13, you started working and coding on your own projects. How did that translate now into your work in AI? How did you kind of get from there to where you are today?
I think knowing how to code is like a skill that allows you a lot, gives you a lot of opportunity on like starting projects, no matter like what kind of project it is. Like it gives you like analytical thinking, it gives you the power to like create things. And from there, it's like not far to like, you know, building a company out of that, for example, building something useful for yourself or for other people. As I said, like smaller projects became to bigger projects, and back, that was like in 2013, AI was not a big thing. I first got in touch with AI, or back then it was called like machine learning. It was like a very primitive form of AI. You started with, you know, a little bit of linear regressions and like decision trees, and doing like, I think deep neural networks became a thing in 2017. Mm-hmm. So like I got in touch with this in 2019, I was a little bit late. And it got really sophisticated only like in maybe early 2020 when large language models emerged. And I was happy enough to be a little bit of an observer for OpenAI and what they're doing. So I got into the wait list for GPT-3 really early. I was like one of the first 6,000 people worldwide to get access to GPT-3. Mm. That was in 2020, so like 2 years before ChatGPT became a thing, and it got like wide adoption. And did like all kinds of different projects. Like we researched a bit on like how we can automate email back and forth with large language models. We researched on how this new technology could be used to like write books, etc. We even published one. And just like 2 months after we published the book, ChatGPT came out, and it was not like something very special anymore, because all of a sudden people understood what the technology can do. Mm-hmm. Like with ChatGPT, the big new thing was it's so accessible. Like everyone understood how to use it. Like AI is not something that the machine learning engineer does now. It's something that everyone can make use of and make useful. But then again, I think the biggest use from large language models comes not from like you interfacing via chat interface with them, but you using them in some broader system, in an automated way, consuming the API of OpenAI, for example, or Anthropic or Google or Amazon or whoever. So in that sense, it was useful and it still is useful. Even though I'm not sure if it gives me like a more intuitive understanding on how to better prompt it. I think it's more about understanding what it can do and like how it can be integrated in broader systems.
Right.
Where did the motivation come from as a 13-year-old to start coding? Is that from your parents or because you just were interested in it in general?
I think that developed like very step by step. Like I got my laptop when I was like 12 years old and that helped like just playing around. And I remember starting just with Excel, like building like some formulas. And I was building games with Excel formulas.
Super cool. What kind of games?
Like just simple games, strategy based, round based games that were just like feasible with like metrics, right? Like a table format. And then, you know, the very next logical step is to like learn Visual Basic for applications, like the VBA, the coding interface of Excel. And then from VBA in Excel, the next logical step is to get to VB.net, which is like more for desktop applications, but still kind of the same language. And then from that, I switched to web development, started with PHP, which retrospectively was like a horrible choice. You don't make your life easy with that. but like the next logical step from PHP then again is like modern frameworks like React. I got a lot into JavaScript environment and from JavaScript then to TypeScript. And this is like where I am today. Like TypeScript is my native language. And, you know, I tried a lot of different things, but this is just like what I think for business applications is the most useful.
Yeah. So you pretty much taught yourself how to code in all of these different languages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want to zoom out now. You were saying that for you, kind of the real leverage point of AI is not per se you engaging with a ChatGPT or a model one-on-one, but it's really using APIs are using these systems for business processes, right? Mm-hmm. So how does that translate into what DigiCust does, for example? Could you maybe explain what, maybe just for the listeners, what customs even is, what point of the process with the declaration you guys work on and how you guys try to help your clients there?
So just as a little bit background, because customs is a very abstract topic, of course, every time you import or export goods from a third country into the European Union, the third country wants to know like what kind of goods leave that country, right? So they can put taxes on that. They also have like statistics on that, etc. And at the same time, like the European Union also wants to know like what kind of goods enter the European Union. So you want to have like an import declaration here. And then you have like all kinds of different paperwork to fill out for this single shipment. And you have forwarding companies, you have customs agents that have customs declarants, is like the job title. And they have like stapels of documents and with invoices, waybills, delivery notes, packing lists, whatsoever, that describe like the goods that are being shipped and how they are being shipped. And their job is literally like to just go through all these documents and check if all the information is there to validate the information, does it make sense? And then basically copy all this information into the computer and do like tariff classifications, etc. So like classification of the product into one of 50,000 different goods categories. And this is like hell of an effort to do that. It's very tedious and it's like very monotonous, right? And I met my co-founder 5 years ago at a hackathon and he worked in customs clearance, like did exactly that process manually at companies like DHL, FedEx, etc. And thought like, oh, there might be a better way to do that. And then we sat together and we developed the first like iteration of what DigiCust is today. And that is like, you just give us like all the documents you have about the shipment. and we take care of it. We read the information on the documents, we make sense out of the information on the documents, we do product classifications, and then we send it to the authorities. And in this whole process of what we're doing, large language models made our life way easier. Like, we started in a time where large language models were not a thing. And today we look back and we restructure a lot of our processes, and it becomes very easy to do like simple classification tasks, for example now. Reading documents, reading pages was like a very difficult thing, because every document is like a different layout, right? It comes from a different shipper. And having like a model that just understands text, that understands visual, you can just like prompt it to return whatever is on the documents. And that's also like an emergent capacity that came out, like that you can use it like this just like a couple of months ago. And before that, we also used it, but like we needed more layers to ensure that there's like more guard railing to like have like stable and explainable output that today is a given, but it just emerges. And I think using it with API, like OpenAI, for example, gives you the opportunity to restrain it to only return JSON output. And then you have like very structured data that you can work with that comes directly from the large language model, instead of just like a JET input output. And you can further use the structured data in whatever business processes you have.
I think something that's like coming to me now, you said that this switch happened only a few months ago, that you could read that the large language models could be so effective without the guardrails that you were speaking of. When you're in an environment using technology that's changing so fast, how do you as an organization keep adapting to it, keep, you know, stay up to date, and also make sure that, you know, quality remains, etc., things like this. How do you keep up?
I think that depends on the organization. Like, we're again a company of like 35 people, so it is still very dynamic, very fast paced. We're a team of like almost only product people, of software engineers, of machine learning engineers. We have a couple of PhD people in our company that studied AI and machine learning, but they still came from like a more machine learning paradigm, right? And we try to like propagate like, okay, let's use large language models more to do stuff. Yeah, it changes a lot. I think every couple of months we have like big new opportunities that come with large language models. Like this JSON mode that I was talking about was like a big new thing. And then when multimodality came out, and we could not only upload text, but also like images, and just get like via simple API backwards on the images. That's like a big game changer. I think what also was a big game changer is like the evolving context length that you could give it. I remember like early GPT-3, you could give it like, I don't know, 4,000 tokens, and you could, like, tokens is, I don't know, that's 2,000 words or something. And that evolved to like Claude, you can prompt with 200,000 context tokens, and that's like a lot of information you can give it with to do reasoning on. It's like many, many book pages you can give it as information. And that also helps with things like hallucination. Like hallucination was a big problem very early, and that comes much better. Like the models become much more aware of what they know, what they're capable of, and what they're not, and just refuse to not do stuff. So like less and less guard railing necessary. We started by not reading like full documents. Like our very early approach was, it was still pre-ChatGPT in a GPT-3 age, where we just use it to like analyze emails, incoming emails. And I remember that was not very robust, that was not very reliable. So like I, at the same time, also implemented regex, regular expressions, to just parse information out of the text if the large language model would not catch it, which again led to a lot of false positives and false negatives. But better than just the large language model itself. And we now got rid of that because it's not necessary anymore.
That's crazy. That's crazy. I'm guessing then you guys do a lot of internal testing as well with these kinds of, with giving them inputs and seeing what happens and testing, making sure that it actually aligns with what you want to create, that it's understandable in terms of output. And it sounds like for Digicus to do what it intends to do, it's a very, like you said, product-driven organization with the people that you have on board. But I mean, we're connected on LinkedIn. Wow. A post came by from yours where you said that really one of the things that you were most proud of is turning Digicust from this essentially three-person team that you started out with into now a more professionalized organization. And so I'm curious, like, what goes into realizing not only a company that, you know, I mean, that's the first part of the question has already been answered, but not only something that's good at developing a great product, but also something that's actually great at realizing it in a professionalized form where you can scale it with 35 people on board. What goes into that professionalization?
I think what a lot of people don't realize is like how much work it is to like build an actual product. Like it's very easy. Like I've built stuff on weekends, on hackathons that work and that you can demo and people are like amazed by what it can do. But that's like just, you know, an early prototype, and like to make like a prototype into like a product that is reliable, that's robust, that's like, that has market validation, that people actually need and solves a real problem, I think is a very time intense learning for an organization or a team. I do think a lot of that has to do with like setting up the right processes. A lot of that has to do with figuring out like what kind of edge cases there are. Like it's very easy to get to like a product that covers 80% of the cases. But then if to get to the last 10 or 20%, it's very, very difficult because you have a lot of like people that use your product in different ways. And you have to kind of cover that, because if you don't cover that, then it doesn't give you the sense of like, oh, I can trust that solution to provide what I want it to do. And even if in 80% of the cases, yes, it works proper, if it in the 20% of the cases does not, then you have a lot of additional cognitive effort in like checking, is the result of the system okay, etc. And that reduces the value of such a system by a lot, because we promise that you don't need people anymore, or way less effort in the people that do customs, for example. But if you then again have to have a human in the loop to check everything and check everything in detail, that takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
So human in the loop is a good opportunity to cover that. And we just try to make the validation processes easy and as fast as possible. So like just give warning messages, and if there's no warning messages, then you're good to go, right? To just like prevent false positives to go through.
How many versions of the software did you guys go through before you actually went, this is market ready now, we can actually do this? How many clients did you have to go to get testing and stuff like that?
I think that's very difficult to say, because versioning is also very, like, for versioning, you have a concept in your head of like, maybe like software version 1, software version 2, software version 3. We always followed the approach of pushing like 5 new features a day. And then you have like 5 versions a day, but we don't call them like software versions, right? It's like just a continuous development of our product. But what I can say is it took us at least a year to get like to a product that we could bring to the first client, and the first client was also not happy, right? The first client was very valuable for us because they gave like a lot of feedback, and a lot of the feedback that we learned from the first client we could then also reuse for the second client again. The second client has like slightly different requirements, so we learned a lot from that again. And so continuously, like every client still is a lot of a learning opportunity. But you also see like how a product becomes more and more scalable over time. Like onboarding a new client back in 2021 took us like at least half a year to get them production ready. And now we sometimes have clients that we get ready in like 2 or 3 weeks, maybe 5 weeks.
Holy crap. That's a massive like step up. Like that's a reduction of almost like 12x or something like this as well in terms of time.
Yeah. And like not only like in terms of like how fast can we get a company online, but also like other processes in the company that are not software related, but just process or related, like how fast we can close a client. Like it was a big win for us. Last year we got bigger investments. So beginning of this year, we hired some salespeople that actually knew how to do sales, that knew how to do marketing, and built like processes that actually work, right? And then closing a client before that took us often like a year. And now we sometimes close within like 1 or 2 months, which is also a big like organizational learning on how to do things, right? And how to do things efficient.
But I think also now you guys have a more substantial track record. Like just looking at the Digicus page, it says, you know, you save 3 to 90 minutes per declaration. There's a 90% error decrease, and you save per declaration, and these happen quite a lot, €1.55 to €50.
Yeah.
So it's, I think building that and doing it in a scalable way, you can show the value like that now, I'm guessing. Yeah.
It also becomes easier because like as soon as the market knows you and like everyone in the logistics industry kind of knows each other, there's like a lot of networks that talk to each other, right? And if you have like a good name there, it definitely helps, like brand building, trust building.
Fair. One actually nice relationship that I have with AI is with you, because there was a phone call we had years ago. I think you were on exchange in California. And you started to show me kind of the first work behind Textress. And this was before GPT was really even available to the public. And you showed me a large language model for the first time in action. And my mind was blown, because I felt like a person when cars started entering the world, you know, these horseless carriages. Mm-hmm. To me, it was an authorless text. It was wild. And it was quite a big wow moment for me. And that's slowly, at least that quick demo that you gave me is now Textures, which is a full blown company. Maybe could you just break down what Textures is, what it does, and how it helps its clients?
How it all started, as you say, like I was in California, I did my university exchange there, and GPT-3 just came out in like a very early release. And I had the same moment, like I had like a wow moment. This like opened so many new opportunities, and it's so easy to build like simple, okay, convert this into that, right? All of a sudden, like this became better at translating things at like all kinds of different language tasks. And the way that you prompted it back then is not like, okay, do this and that. But the way that you prompted it is was more advanced. You're like, you needed a little bit more of actual prompt engineering. You needed to show it examples on what to do, right? You need to give it like, okay, I'll start and you just finish that text paragraph. Because it was not like trained on following instructions, it was trained to like predict the next token. And at the same time, it felt like it is a lot of work to like actually build products or actually build software products out of that. And my idea was we can simplify that by just building like a solution where you can just input like basic on what kind of prompt or like what kind of purpose does this function have, like really a function input, function output, and quickly build front ends also for that. Like it came with like a build a full stack application in 5 minutes using large language models. And that worked, and we discovered like a lot of different use cases. I was in California, a lot of like people in LA that were in like the movie industry, and we discovered like how could we automate movie scripts, for example, and all kinds of different use cases. Marketing was like a big thing, like content creation. And I started doing this, and technically it worked, and technically we also got a couple of users. I don't know, it was like 100 or 200 users back then. But it was like difficult to really monetize or stay competitive within like an environment where also like not only I discovered that use case, but like also other people, other teams discovered the use case. And me being occupied with Digicast, me being occupied also with university, didn't have like the capacity that other teams had. So I was like, maybe I should pivot. And the pivot was in direction, okay, let's teach organizations on how to make use of that, to exploit that. So we started building more kind of like a consultancy, and I built like a team of like 6-7 people that all had some kind of background with large language models already, and also like a technical background, and that very much helped in building like an initial consultancy that helps organizations adopt AI, teaches it like how to use AI, and that became like very apparent like in value when ChatGPT came out, and you can actually show like, okay, this is what it can do. Now, how do we integrate this into your business processes? And that also allowed like to go into like really big companies like very early on and without much track record actually. So like just being at the right time with the right product.
So companies would then come to you and be like, we have this problem within our company we would like to solve with AI. How could we do this? Is that the kind of way I should think about it?
Like right now, they're more coming to us to like, hey, we see there's stuff going on. Like we see there's like new technology, the technology that will change like everything. Everyone is like hyped about it. We just have no way of like making use of it. And a lot of companies, they don't know how to identify use cases that they could automate with AI. A lot of them don't have like the infrastructure to anyways make use of that at all. So we first started a lot with educating clients, like doing workshops with them. We have like a product that's called the CAIO as a service, where we literally just put like one of our experts into a company and build like the capacity to adopt AI from within, right? To like build the right teams within the company, to hire the right people within the company, to build processes to allow, again, use case identification, but also then the implementation, right? And after implementation, you also have like some kind of putting processes in place to like actually have people use this thing, right? And to have like observability and monitoring of that whole AI thing, and to make sure it's all compliant with regulations, etc. So like there's a lot that comes with, I want to have AI in my company. But like the big first big first step is to actually identify like, where can I apply AI in my organization?
And beyond just kind of educating your clients now, are you also moving towards implementing it more and more for them?
Yeah.
Okay. And what kind of, it's really about automating text-based processes, right? So could you maybe give some examples of things that you guys work on?
I can give some examples. So like different industries have different use cases. We work like in legal tech, we work in medicine technology or healthcare technology. We work in law enforcement. We have like projects in all kind of different directions. And some use cases might be, hey, you have like a lot of data, how you can make them accessible.
So speaking of Textures, of course you have this prior experience with Digicast, and I could imagine that there's a lot of lessons that you're pulling out of Digicast that you can apply to Textures, and maybe even vice versa. Could you expand on that?
There's definitely like a lot of overlap, a lot of like learnings from a technical perspective that I had at Digicast and then I'm applying to Textures, and also from like an organization perspective, a lot of how we founded Textures and how we put like leadership and how we put like processes on top, we learned from Digicast, so like transfer learned into Textures. At the same time, I learn a lot from my colleagues at Textures on like how large language models work, on like what they're using it and in what architectures, in what forms of applications, the usage, right? And then also putting this back to Digicast, like one of our core products at Digicast is our custom steric classification. So like taking like a product description and going from product description into like one of literally 50,000 different categories that goes as specific as like how much sugar does your drink entail, right? And that's like a really hard problem with hierarchical classifications. And we had like a similar problem at Textures, and then I could just like cross transfer this to like where we needed it at Digicast. I think that's very valuable to like be part of multiple organizations and see like how different people do different things and cross apply it. That's also, I was also always in university when I was working on my companies and applying like what I learned there to like my work professional context. Mm. Also very valuable, like having this third party perspective and a little bit more of a serendipity and synergies that can occur.
Well, what kind of lessons did you pull from university? Because sometimes I have them as well, but a lot of the time it's theoretical fluff. So what kind of lessons have you taken now to your companies?
I think it's often not very tangible learnings and often not very technical learnings, like a learning on how to do things is something that I don't get from university. Like this is just nothing that university is good at giving you, right? Yeah. Giving you like frameworks or something, you end up doing something else. But it gives you like a little bit, like what university gave me most is developing myself like as an individual, like in thinking, etc. I think getting more intuitive in things, in thinking, more theoretical. I was like always like a very hands-on, very observant type of thinker, where I like see stuff and I act on it. And I think at university I learned to be like more theoretically, more abstract, seeing like the bigger picture. And I think that comes very valuable. I had some technical courses as well at university that of course helped like understanding conceptual stuff. I think the terminologies that I use like vocabulary wise are much better suited now than they were like just from intuitive on the go learning, and that also helps in discovering and further advancing your knowledge.
Yeah, I could imagine also with like literally just knowing the jargon and the actual words. Yes. For it. That's something that I was running into a lot with my work was, okay, a lot of it was self-learned as well and self-taught. So I'd be using completely wrong terms when I would maybe go to a client because I was never actually told what it meant. I used my own word to label the same phenomena or concept.
And at the same time, university also like urges you like to read academic papers and like to understand like how to read academic papers. And I'm like reading papers on especially large language model stuff like every day. We have like also like a cool group chat of like 300 people that are really like in this bubble of large language models and like sharing what they're currently reading and what they're finding interesting and like what's going on in the market. And like that's something university provided me with and I find very valuable.
Is that large group chat AIM?
Yeah, that's like part of AIM.
Okay, so that's AIM. Could you maybe expand on what AIM actually is?
Sure. So we found that like we're in a bubble of like people that actually understand large language models, that work with large language models like on a daily basis. And there's ever more of those people, but there was not like 2 years ago. And it kind of still is like a small bubble of people that actually are into the research and application of those. And we started by just like making a WhatsApp group chat and putting those people together and exchanging ideas, exchanging research papers, exchanging like best practices that people are actively using in their work. And we now recently formalized this as like an incorporated association and try to have like a non-profit around this community and organize hackathons, organize events where companies can learn and can also find access to talent that knows large language models. Because as also already said, building capacity in organizations for adopting those AI is very difficult. And if you have like access to a talent pool, then that's very valuable. At the same time, those people also like to get access to those organizations.
And the problems that you guys want to solve are largely society driven, right?
Yes.
So the low productivity and growth that we're seeing here, especially in Europe, or at least the slowdown we have in it, and also the changes in population demographics is quite a big theme in many places around the world, but also here. So essentially leveraging large language models to help solve those issues, or maybe these hackathons and things like this. Is that a correct understanding?
Exactly, like it's mostly societal issues. Our last hackathon, for example, was on sustainability reporting, which is like a really big topic and a very impactful topic. And at the same time, there's not a lot of money in it, right? Like it's important to have like nonprofits also like figuring things out and pushing things.
Alrighty. Then now, Thomas, we've spoken about your three main ongoing projects now, Digicus, Texturus, and of course AIM as well. I want to take a moment to zoom out. So large language models as a whole, like we spoke about this, they're changing really rapidly. And it might be an obscene question seeing how fast this is happening, but how do you envision their application changing in the next decade?
A decade is a long time.
Yeah.
In large language models, it's a long time.
That's why I said with the obscene frame of a decade, just because I wanted to test and see where your thinking is, like, on that time horizon.
In a decade of a time horizon, I think they will take like a lot of share of global GDP, like a lot of share. We already see this happening, like in high productivity gains, and you already see in a lot of knowledge fields that unemployment gets higher. It's like people are worth much less already. Like finding a job now is much more difficult, because with the same amount of people and with the help of AI, you can already do much, much more. And that's still in a paradigm right now where you as a human have to supervise large language models in a lot of ways still. They are slowly being integrated into like actually taking over processes in organizations. Like we do with Digicast, for example. So like we're slowly automating the job of a customs declarant. At the same time, this still needs like human supervision. 10 years is a long time. And I think agentic large language models that like do not need supervision, but can supervise themselves and like interact with their environment directly and solve problems and interact with other agents, whether it being human agents or AI agents. That's definitely something that will come very soon. We see like small things of that already happening, like Anthropic introduced their computer use, where an AI agent can like control your computer and do stuff, right? But still that comes with a lot of limitations. It's not very good yet, and at the same time we have again this context window problem where you can only feed it with so much contextual information, and humans still have like a lot more contextual information. Like if they're embedded in an organization, they understand how things work and how things work in that environment, then that's just something that AI cannot do yet. But I would only give it a couple of years until we're there.
Yeah, I think is a very important word in that sentence.
Exactly. So like agentic agents will become a big thing, I think. Like that's my bet. I think also like intelligence just will scale. Right now, you still see like a ChatGPT or a Claude do mistakes, right? And this will become much less, and the purposes for you which you use it, which will become much more sophisticated. I also think that as intelligence scales, like right now we see it surpassing in a lot of levels human intelligence, like of individuals in their respective fields. And I think OpenAI provided like a very good classification of like how advanced AI is, and there's like one level that's like literally organization level, like how can we get AI, or like what is AI that covers like the intelligence of a whole organization. And I think that's where things become really powerful. Right now in pharma companies, for example, you have a lot of specialists. You have a lot of you have people who are very specialized in like how the metabolism in cells work, and another one who knows like exactly how the cardiovascular system in humans work. Another one that knows like how the neural system in humans work. And in organizations, like communicating all of these and finding like a common sense making of that is a very time intense process. And that's also why pharma companies, for example, are very slow in what they're doing. And if all of that is happening in like one big neural network, then I can imagine that there's like a really fast takeoff in research in a lot of fields.
Yeah.
I'm joking with friends that it's probably more likely that I'll live until like age 150 than that in 20 years I will still have a job. I'm a knowledge worker.
Yeah. So do you think AI could actually replace your job in, let's say, 10, 20 years?
I would hope not in 10 years, but I'm very certain in like, I see it coming. I don't know the timeline. I know it's very feasible, and I know it could be possible in like 3 years. It could also be like in 5 years. It could be in 10 years, maybe in 20 years. I would hope in 30 years, but...
I'm sure we'll find something else then to work on as well that AI then can't go, because I was going to ask as well, is there any industries you see where AI will not be able to replace the human?
I don't necessarily see a niche where it would not theoretically be possible to replace it with AI. I think I see the argument a lot that robotics, for example, is a thing that, like anything mechanical, where you have to use your hands, like being a plumber, for example, that is stuff that AI can take over. And I would agree that I think intelligence is much more developed than robotics right now, but I think there's also a lot of money flowing into robotics. And at the same time, if you have robotics, as in you have the actuators, etc., like the robotic hardware, and you have to just like implant some intelligence into it to like really be able to interact with the world the way a human does, then this is also like a solvable problem, right?
Yeah.
And that's a problem that's solvable within very reasonable time. So like that's something that I don't think is unique to humans. Then you could say that you could make an argument. You could make an argument for any kind of entertainment industry, right? If you want to see like a concert live, right? You need like to have people there. But at the same time, you see like more and more of the entertainment is taken over by an Instagram algorithm or a TikTok algorithm. I think that's also just diminishing, and people are just too expensive or don't deliver that quality that an AI could do potentially, right? I think service industry is something that could live on for a little bit longer. Like you have just inherent value that human delivers your food, like as a waiter or waitress in a restaurant. I think that's going to be for longer. But like anything that's just knowledge input and knowledge output, I think gets replaced very quickly.
Then what kind of skills do you think would still be important for people to stay relevant?
It's really hard to say for me. I think like in the short term, like next 5 years, I think it's like just how to use AI and like as simple as like just work with a ChatGPT or a Claude and see like to understand it and to make yourself like useful using those agents. Might be that in the midterm, this is not like a relevant skill anymore, because also those become more and more independent from humans. I think anything service industry is probably the most safe.
Nice. Learn how to take an order.
Where you actually have an inherent value of having like a human being.
Yes. Yeah. Being sociable.
Exactly.
Yeah. on that notion of zooming out to a decade or at least trying to, what are your longer term goals as an entrepreneur and as an innovator in the AI space?
Yeah, again, betting that I'm not going to be replaced within the time frame. No, like I'm focusing very heavily on Digicast right now, and this is also where I see myself like doing the next 5 to 10 years. Like we are in a space, in an opportunity where we have market validation, we have a product that works, we have a market that's growing, that's also accepting us. I think, and like we know that we can make money and have like costs that are diminishing. It's like a business model that just works and is something that we now want and need to exploit. And that's where I'm putting my focus now.
Very understandable. From an outside perspective, that's very understandable even. So makes sense.
If there's any listener out now trying or wanting to start a company in AI, what space do you think is the most interesting right now to enter in terms of AI?
I think if you want to start a company, you should start with a use case first. Like you are working right now like a particular job and you have like a very particular problem in this job. And for my colleague, for example, it was customs is just tedious. Let's automate that specific process. Yeah. So like going from a use case first, because you know that particular industry, you know a particular company, you know exactly what kind of a problem there is that other people might not have. I think if you go for the obvious things like, oh, let's replace lawyers, a lot of people are doing that right now, like a lot of companies, and you're gonna compete, right? And you don't want to be in a space where you have to compete with like 100 different companies. Mm-hmm. You want to be like in a niche and start out with a niche and build capacity there. And that should be, yeah, specific to one use case.
Right. Falling in love with the problem that you have at hand and not per se the solution of AI in its totality.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fair.
And best case, that's something that's text-based, where reasoning, human reasoning helps, because that's like an emergent or new technology, new opportunity to automate. And yeah, I think one thing that people need to be careful about is, do we expect that your problem that you're trying to solve with your product that you have now, how easy is it that a ChatGPT or the next iteration of Claude will do all of that for you, or that users are more keen on just using ChatGPT directly instead of your solution?
Yeah, that's also the reason why I asked the question, because we're now partners at the University Challenge here. And the first evening we went, I think we heard 5 or 6 people just using the AI app to automate or make it better how you eat, or how you do sports. And we looked at each other and we were like, well, you can just ask chat right now on make a food plan for me, and you get the healthiest food plan with your allergies taken into consideration. So there's a lot of people who are trying to do stuff with AI, but it's, I wouldn't say it's useless, but it's already done by others and much bigger companies.
I think you can still make it useful by, again, putting like those guardrails, like making the output very consistently and enriching the output, right? Like ChatGPT as such is not good at making you a food plan, right? Maybe you also want to have like a daily reminder on your phone, like what to eat today and what to buy groceries with, right? That using ChatGPT for would be possible, but it comes with more mental effort for people, and they have to actively think about like, oh, what do I actually want to ask?
So it's the easiness of it that can get improved.
You can add value by building a ChatGPT wrapper.
Yeah,
but also your copy ability, like that people can copy you, is also very easy.
Yeah.
And you should be aware of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is to me where, at least I think it was way more than 5 or 6. I think it was basically every single company was saying like, and we do this with AI, which is fair enough. Like, it's a technology, you should use it. But they tried to use it as the differentiating factor, which I think if you're doing that now on a lot of the processes, then you're...
It was 2 years ago.
Exactly, yes. And that's the point. It was 2 years ago, but maybe now it should be more standard practice. And that's where companies like Textures come in, of course. But yeah. Anyway, I think we can wrap it up now.
Yeah.
Thomas, we ask our guests to bring an object of personal significance. What did you bring today and why?
I'm not a person that has a lot of like physical objects to bring or that have a high significance to me. So what I did bring is a book. This is probably the book that influenced my life most. I've read it quite a few years ago and it just changed my perspective on how evolution works, give me an intuition about how people collaborate, how organizations work, and also how intelligence works. And the book I'm talking about is Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. I think it just gives like a lot of really valuable perspectives, even if it's not like directly business related or directly related to AI or stuff that I'm doing. I think it gives like very valuable intuitions in life. And you can connect a lot of those intuitions back to, again, how intelligence works and how organizations work. And that's just the core of what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of the book as well. And it's just, it gives you such an understanding of the world that we live in and why it is what it is today. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go back and read it now. I'm going to go get the book for the Christmas break.
Yeah. No, it's really, it's spectacular. I enjoy it a lot as well.
Yeah.
I've read it like 3 times, I think, now as well. So I enjoy it.
If there's one book that you should read 3 times, then it's this one.
Yeah.
It's like a battle for me. It's a lot of like, really like every page you put up and it's like pure valuable information. It's like in very pure form. I think Yuval Noah Harari did a very good job in writing it.
Have you read his other work as well? Like Homo Deus and...
I've read like 2 more of his books. Mm. Deus was one of them.
Yeah.
And I think the 21 Lessons
as
well. But this one is for sure my most favorite one.
Agreed.
I think he also wrote the book on Nexus, like on AI. I haven't read it yet.
I can
imagine that it's really good as well, but also he's more of an abstract thinker and not like a technical AI person. And I think there's often some not overlap of like understanding of not AI or not technical people on AI and understanding of like what's actually going on. But it helps shaping new perspectives for sure.
Agreed. Thomas, thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming.
Really appreciate
it. Thanks for the invitation.
You're very welcome. And we'll see you soon. Okay. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to our episode. If you want to connect with our guest personally, then give us a follow on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram at First Moves Podcast. And lastly, we ask you to leave a review. This will enable us to bring better guests on board and give you better content in the future. Have a nice day.